Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
It is Tuesday, August 26th. Welcome, welcome, friends, into the show. I am Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Today's show is one of those let's catch up on it because you might have missed it types of shows. A lot going on in the news, so you might have overlooked the fact that there's been some major policy changes around vaccines at the federal level ever since RFK Jr. took over as HHS secretary. One of the biggest ones was firing everyone on a major vaccine advisory panel. So today we're going to talk about that move, what could be coming down the pike. One of our guests used to be on that panel. We also have a health and science accountability reporter from the Washington Post with us in the second segment and third segment today. So we'll tee all that up with a question. Who do you trust for vaccine information? Where do you get your health advice? Your doctor, public health officials, friends, the internet? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2 at whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop your comment in the chat.
Yeah, I know people probably get advice about vaccines, about other health information from all sorts of places. So very interested in hearing what you have to say. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2 at whyy.org. We have our trio of news stories.
Trio.
Yes. Top story here. If you were listening to NPR, you may have heard about it, but President Donald Trump has signed an executive order targeting cities that employ cashless bail. And now Philadelphia's district attorney Larry Krasner is speaking out. He is defending the city's use of cashless bail in some cases. Let me tell you about this executive order. It calls for Attorney General Pam Bondi to identify cities that have eliminated cash bail. And as you know, and this is a potential use of this is in for pretrial release in cases and the judge gives you a chance to get out while you await your actual trial. The administration would review that list and possibly target some of the cities federal funding to be cut. So Philadelphia hasn't fully eliminated cash bail, but it does employ cashless options for a myriad of nonviolent and misdemeanor offenses ranging from prostitution to drug possession. And Krasner's office issued a statement where the DA is quoted as saying it is no surprise that the president, who he calls a, quote, wealthy 34-time convicted felon capable of posting his own bail, is targeting these types of policies. Now, about 70% of people who were inside state and inside county jails had been awaiting pre-trial hearings. They were waiting there for their trial. And many of these folks would lose their homes. They would lose their cars. Some of their children will be put in foster care. And then sometimes they would get probation or even have their case totally dismissed. And this is why many cities started eliminating cash bail, because people who couldn't afford it would end up losing everything. And so
suffer consequences just because
exactly.
You were accused of a crime.
And sometimes, yeah, I've talked to people who've had their cases ultimately dismissed.
Right.
And so, as you know, I mean, Republicans and conservatives have criticized these types of policies as soft on crime.
Yeah, and this fits in the same bucket as the threats around the sanctuary city status.
Yes.
The big question that's still hanging out there is, then what? So you write these executive orders, you say you might mess with the federal funding of Philadelphia, which is large. Like, Philadelphia cannot afford to lose all of its federal funding or even a large chunk of it. But the rubber just hasn't hit the road on this, so it's hard to know what to make of these threats until the actual conflict happens between a city, could be Philadelphia, and the federal government.
Yeah, and it's part of it is scare tactics, right? To try to see if cities will change
sure.
their policies.
Sure, yeah. And I mean, but Philadelphia really hasn't changed anything on either of these fronts so far. Let's stay on politics now.
Yep.
Big shakeup in Democratic leadership here in the state of Pennsylvania. Sharif Street, who is a state senator from Philly and the son of former Mayor John Street, stepped down yesterday as head of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party because he is running for Congress in 2026 to replace Dwight Evans, who is retiring. That's a big race and a crowded field. The Inquirer's Julia Tarusa reports that Street will endorse Eugene DePasquale as his replacement. DePasquale is a former state rep, auditor general. He recently lost a bid for attorney general. So that's a big name to replace Street. Mm-hmm. PA Dems looking for some leadership right now. Hasn't been a great couple years for Pennsylvania Dems on the registration front, obviously, at the ballot box. So this is a big job. There's a lot of work to do.
Yeah. And the Democrats have been saying they wanted somebody to chair the party full time. They did not want somebody who was also working and doing this. Sure. And, you know, Eugene DePasquale can do that. He has some time to do that. Also, if you... Also, if you read the tea leaves from that story, I got the implication that Governor Josh Shapiro kind of wanted Street out so that they could get somebody in full time. Also, another little piece of tea there, Philadelphia Democratic City Chair Bob Brady apparently had backed Street a few years ago when he ran over Shapiro's objection to be state chair. Hmm. And he seems to have think, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer, that he was put in the proverbial doghouse ever since then. So now he's making sure that he backs Shapiro's chosen chair this time.
You need one of those like push pins with the red string, one of those like big cork boards to follow all of this.
That was it, because he wants to get back in good graces.
Politics is complicated, mm-hmm. folks. All right, story number three.
Yes, Stephen Starr's latest restaurant is slated to open. It's open this week in Rittenhouse Square. It's a new Italian bistro. It's called Borromini. And apparently folks have been chomping at the bit for this place to open. That's according to Philadelphia Magazine. And this space, which is inside the old Barnes & Nobles at 18th and Walnut, cost about $20 million to renovate. It's huge, two stories, 15,000 square feet. And it's Stephen Starr's first restaurant opening in Philly since 2021 when he launched LMNO in Kensington/Fishtown.
You did a very Philly thing there, which is what you added an S to Barnes & Noble.
That's I know. A, did I a, do
You said Barnes
Philly?
And Nobles.
I know.
That is
I know.
The most. People do that all the time here. I would love to hear a
That's
story
like saying
about
use.
That. Yeah, it's just a thing. People are always adding S's. Mm-hmm. So what, you want my reaction to this?
I do want your, I mean, and you're a foodie. You're the, between the two of us,
stop.
You're more of a foodie than me.
Stop. I mean, look, I'm probably not going to go to Borromini. It doesn't seem like my type of place when it comes to Italian food.
You do like a more sandwich and.
Yeah. I like places that end in S actually, like a Ritchie's, an Antonio's, a Paisano's, a Cosmi's, you know what I mean? So I don't think it's my type of place, but here's the thing, like people turn their nose up at Stephen Starr restaurants these days. Mm-hmm. And I think, to be fair to him, it's a sign of how much the restaurant scene has grown around him. And he is responsible for elevating the Philadelphia restaurant scene. A lot of the great chefs have come through his restaurants. So people say, like, Starr restaurants are basic. And I get that on some level. But at the same time, like, he's also responsible in part for why there is such a big bustling restaurant scene here in Philadelphia. He was one of the people that proved the concept that you can do higher end dining here in Philadelphia and really make a mark. So I try not to be, you know, too harsh on the Stephen Starr restaurants.
Yeah, I mean, his menu has 100-layer lasagna, lobster spaghetti. Sounds good to me. But my take on Stephen Starr is this. I've never been blown away by any dish I've ever had at
That's
a
fair.
Stephen Starr restaurant.
That's
I
fair.
Always go for the drinks and the vibes.
And the vibes are often
And the vibes
good.
Are part of it. Yeah. But I have never had a dish at a Stephen Starr restaurant that I've said, it's so unforgettable, I got to go back there and spend $26 on it again.
Like, totally.
That's never happened to me. I don't know. Other people may feel a different way, but you're right.
I think
he did elevate chefs.
I think like the Starr restaurants are like a starter pack for when you're getting into the Philly restaurant mm-hmm. scene. They're a lot of fun. The design is often like really... cool.
Oh, yeah. Lots
the
of
vibes
thought.
Are nice mm-hmm. often, not all mm-hmm. of them, but often the vibes are really nice. You can count on the service. And then once you do that, you start to spread your wings a little bit and you just test out some of the other independent restaurants in the city. But I think like it's good to have a starter pack. Like I feel like I went to more Starr restaurants when I was just new here.
Yeah.
And a lot of people would recommend them and they always had a good time. And then you would say like, what's that place down the street? And then you go there.
And then I feel like there's other places where you'll get your favorite dish, but I do like lobster and I like spaghetti. So, you know, if somebody invites me.
Who doesn't
me,
like lobster and spaghetti?
I would go.
Yeah,
you know?
If you're paying, I'm going. Let me just correct the record. If someone would pay for me to go to Borromini.
I would go.
I would go there. But This is his most anticipated opening in a long time.
Yeah.
You
and
know, like,
because he has spread his wings and he's totally 40 restaurants all up and down the East Coast. He's
his
doing
Philly
his
heyday was like a decade or two ago, but this is like his, one of his big first like statement restaurants in a while. So it's kind of interesting to see how it does.
So somebody invites you, like if somebody invites me, I'll go.
If you want to take me to Borromini and pay for the 100 layer lasagna, I'll eat it. Just to clarify, I will eat it. Okay, so we're going to change tone, shift topic now. Because today on the show, we're talking about big changes to federal vaccine policy under RFK Jr. We want to know from you, who do you trust for vaccine information? Where do you get your health advice? Doctor, public health officials, friends, the internet? Call 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. When President Trump nominated Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to be Secretary of Health and Human Services, many public health experts worried about his long history of vaccine skepticism. Well, now that Kennedy is leading HHS, has that skepticism translated to action?
The simple answer is yes. Most notably, Kennedy fired every member of a key vaccine advisory panel and replaced them with his own appointments. That panel has started to turn heads with its actions, but it's possible the more stunning news is yet to come.
Today, we'll discuss how Kennedy has changed American vaccine policy and research with a pair of experts. Paul Offit is director of the Vaccine Education Center and a professor of pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at Penn. Welcome back, Paul.
Thank you. Happy to be back.
And with us via Zoom is Lauren Weber, health and science accountability reporter for The Washington Post. Lauren, it's really nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And we invite our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere to chime in. Our question of the day is this: whose vaccine advice do you trust most? Your doctor, public health experts, RFK, school, do you do your own research on the internet? And tell us why. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, Facebook, be sure to drop your comments in the live chat. And I want to start the conversation, just level set, with a caller. We have Elise from Abington on the line. Elise, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thank you so much. I'm a frequent listener. My comment is that when you were leading up to the show, you mentioned shifting recommendations about these vaccines. And I just want to be clear, this isn't shifting recommendations. Shifting recommendations is what happens when there's science and research that changes over time, which it's supposed to do. What's happening now is the outright destruction of our scientific infrastructure. So I think it's actually dangerous to call these shifting recommendations, and better labeled the destruction or removal of appropriate scientifically based recommendations.
Thank you, Elise. Thank you, Elise. A strong comment to start. So let's talk about, I think we said that term, shifting recommendations, when we're talking about what the federal government officially recommends on some vectors, not everything, right? So Lauren Weber, I wanted to start with one of the big headlines, which is the replacement of everyone on this major advisory panel. So get us up to speed on what happened and a little bit on what that panel has done since it completely turned over.
Yeah, so in an unprecedented move, Kennedy fired and got rid of the entire 17-member panel of ACIP, which was an esteemed collection of folks with medical degrees, professorships, who had done plenty of research on vaccines and vaccine-related issues. And he replaced it with originally 8, but ended up being 7 hand-picked members that he had chosen, several of whom, public health experts said to me, just did not have the same level of credentials that the previous folks had had. Now, he did this under what he said was trying to remove conflicts of interest. That said, the folks that have been added all have, many of them, some of them have said different things about vaccines that have raised questions about their objectivity. And, you know, since they have had their first ACIP meeting, they announced that they'd be reviewing the childhood vaccine schedule, which has been a long time goal of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s in the lead up to him becoming HHS secretary as an anti-vaccine activist. They also indicated they would remove thimerosal from multi-dose flu vaccine vials, which, you know, many public health experts, and Paul can speak more clearly to this, considered entirely unnecessary and to be the validation of an anti-vaccine trope. And there's been rumblings that they will be looking more at the COVID vaccines and other vaccines in the upcoming meetings this year and next.
All right, Paul Offit. Mm-hmm. All of that taken into consideration, what's the thing in there that really stands out to you as the most significant when you look at what ACIP has done since it was reconfigured?
Well, so Lauren said it well. So the what they had at that last meeting is they had an anti-vaccine activist who had created a group called Safe Minds and then was part of something called Children's Health Defense, which is RFK Jr.'s anti-vaccine organization. They had her present data on whether or not we should no longer allow thimerosal-containing flu vaccines to be on the market. Now, thimerosal-containing flu vaccines are completely safe. I was on the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices between 1998 and 2003 when we considered this, and there were study after study after study that showed you were at no risk of any sort of neurodevelopmental problems if you had received thimerosal-containing vaccines as compared to if you received thimerosal-free vaccines. So what ended up happening then is after her presentation, by a vote of 5-1, they voted to basically not allow thimerosal-containing influenza vaccines to be on the market. Now, that's a trivial hit. It may Maybe it's 4% of the vaccines.
Yeah, because most of the vaccines don't have this anyway.
Right, so you can still easily get a flu vaccine. But what that showed you is they were willing to make an anti-science vote, and that is just round one of what I think is about to be a series of anti-science votes under the leadership of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., as Secretary of HHS.
It was the fact that they went along with what was like a longtime goal of RFK Jr., and then they actually put that thing into action. That's what stood out to you.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Now, you have expressed concern that, you know, we could possibly lose vaccines in this country. I want you to kind of explain what you mean by that and what, you know, decisions like this, the actual ripple effect that they could possibly have.
So if you want to destroy vaccines in this country, do what happened in the 1980s, which is before we had a vaccine injury compensation program, sue vaccine makers. Because it's a small market product. It's something you take once or a few times in your lifetime. It's never going to compete with these big market products that you take every day, like lipid-lowering agents or things like that. So that's what he wants to do. What I think is about to happen...
What's your evidence for that? That's the direction he wants to go, is basically make it, I guess, not profitable to deliver vaccines.
Right. So he has said that he wants to reconfigure the vaccine injury compensation program. What that means for him is that he wants to either take... safety issues that aren't really safety issues, like autism, diabetes, or multiple sclerosis, and either add it to the list of compensable injuries or take certain vaccines out of the protection of the vaccine injury compensation program and just leave them open to the slings and arrows of outrageous civil litigation, which is what happened in the 1980s when we went from 18 companies that made vaccine in 1980 to 4 by the end of the decade.
And walk us through that. So that would mean that, you know, some of the ailments that people have falsely alleged vaccines cause, people could actually sue these vaccine manufacturers for them.
Either through the program or just outside of the program. He is going to hold up a paper in the next few months claiming that aluminum adjuvants in vaccines cause whatever. Autism is my bet. And then he's going to say this is gold standard science. This is landmark science when it's going to be anything other than that. And then he's going to manipulate that program, which will make vaccines less available, less affordable, and more feared. That's his goal. He's an anti-vaccine activist. He's not a vaccine skeptic. I'm a vaccine skeptic. I mean, sitting around at the virtual table at the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee, show us the data. Prove it's safe. Prove it's effective. He's worse than that. He's a science denialist, which makes him a dangerous man.
Of course, he's pointed to the fact he said his kids are vaccinated. He's not against all vaccines. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, he has also said if he could go back in time, he would spend any amount of money not to vaccinate his children.
Sure.
He says that when he sees a parent holding a child on a biking path or hiking path, that he goes up to them and says, don't vaccinate your child. He's also said that he's not going to take away vaccines from people who want them. And what he's about to do is, I think in the next couple of days, they are going to not allow Pfizer's vaccine for children less than 5 years of age, take away their emergency use authorization, which will leave only the Moderna vaccine, which is only going to be available for children who are in high-risk categories. Now, if you look at the data...
We're talking COVID here.
We're talking,
I'm sorry, yes, COVID vaccines. I'm sorry. So There was a presentation at the CDC recently where they tried to answer the question, is COVID still a problem in children? And what they found was that thousands of children over the past year were hospitalized. 1 in 5 were admitted to the intensive care unit. Virtually all were unvaccinated. Half were previously healthy, and 152 children died. Is that a disease worth preventing? Of course it is. But now you're about to only have a vaccine for children who are in high risk, knowing that half of the children who were hospitalized and died were previously healthy. So he does take away vaccines for people who want them.
And you know, Lauren, I want to ask you, I mean, when the HHS basically changes recommendations, what's the trickle effect? Does that mean, you know, insurance doesn't offer it? Explain us what these recommendations actually mean for patients and parents and people all across the country.
Oh, I mean, we've already seen the impact of some of the recommendations that ACIP made around COVID and other things. You know, if they change recommendations, states, some pharmacies will refuse to cover it. They'll say it's not available. You know, we're seeing a kind of a brewing war. The American Academy of Pediatrics has put out a statement with alternative vaccine recommendations from the federal government, saying they don't trust the federal government's recommendations. And I think we'll see how that continues to play out. But in many states, in the legislation and laws, they rely upon ACIP's recommendations. So there really could be changes in access that could flow from this. And as Paul pointed out, there, you know, if it's not profitable for vaccine companies to make vaccines, you're going to see less of them. And that, too, could create an access problem. I think it's also important, you know, you were talking about the COVID vaccine and what Kennedy has said previously. I think it's important to call out that and to repeat that Kennedy's own words around the COVID vaccine. He has previously called it the deadliest vaccine ever made, which is a false statement. And he has said that there's a poison in the COVID vaccine. And so, you know, there's a lot of concern from public health officials that I speak to that with that kind of rhetoric and previous feelings about the COVID vaccine, what could that mean going forward?
I do want to bring in some more comments and calls because we do have folks waiting. But I just want to go back to this kind of doomsday scenario, Paul, that you laid out, where the liability from lawsuits makes it so vaccine manufacturers just stop producing lots of vaccines. I guess I do wonder at that point, I wonder broadly whether RFK Jr., even if that's his goal, could truly get away with it. I mean, the idea that there would not be a total parent revolt and freakout in this country if you straight up could not get your child vaccinated against major childhood illnesses. I know politics has changed a lot over the last 10 years, but I'm struggling to see how any administration could possibly survive that. Because still, 90% plus get vaccinated.
Yeah, they do.
You're right. I think you're right. I think we'll find out just how much we're willing to take. I got a call yesterday from a pediatrician in North Carolina who said that he was seeing parents. Father was a construction worker. Mom worked at home. They were Republicans. And the mother was worried. She said, are our children going to be able to have vaccines? You're right. Independent of your political affiliation, most people value vaccines. Mm-hmm. And we'll see just how far you can push them before they finally stand up, march into their congressman's office and say, this is enough.
Mm. Yeah. By the way, I want to remind our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere of our question of the day. It is, who do you trust for vaccine information? Where do you get your health advice? Your doctor, public health officials, friends? Do you get it on the internet? You can call us. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube and Facebook, you can drop your comment in the chat. I want to bring in a caller. We have Ryan from New Jersey on the line. Ryan, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is the fact that I wouldn't trust anything out of this administration. RFK was nominated for loyalty. He was confirmed along party lines, and he's been so opposed to vaccines and the science behind them, and everything he's saying now, as far as, oh, yeah, supportive of vaccines, it just seems to play, just to try to make him look better. But he's obviously against all of that. So he's the last person I would trust as far as health information.
Thank you. That's Ryan. Thank you. That's Ryan from New Jersey on the line. Rachel says, RFK Jr. is the last person I trust. She kind of agrees with Ryan. She says, I would say in order, I trust the experts, meaning researchers and organizations like the CDC when they're not under Trump's thumb, and then my doctor. Why? Because I believe science, I believe in science, and I understand that recommendations can change as we make new discoveries. Paul, I wanted to kind of ask you about this confusion when you have pediatricians sort of recommending something different than you have the CDC or the HHS or the ACIP, right, recommending. What kind of tension, when we ask our listeners, who do you trust? You're getting conflicting recommendations. Sort of give advice, like, what is the impact of this when one entity is saying this, your doctor's telling you something else, research is saying something else?
I love these callers, first of all. Yeah. I want to make that clear. But look at what RFK Jr. did. He stood up on a one-minute video on X. He said, we, Health and Human Services, are no longer recommending this vaccine for healthy young children, which it was directly at variance with the data that had been presented to the CDC, that thousands of children were getting hospitalized, they were getting admitted to the ICU, some were dying, half were healthy. And so that was directly at variance with those data. So what did the American Academy of Pediatrics do? They stood up and in a black letter publication said, this vaccine is recommended for young children who've never been vaccinated or naturally infected. And RFK Jr. was angry. So what did he do? He did what he always does, because he's a one-trick pony. He pointed to the American Academy of Pediatrics and said, you know, they're just in the pocket of the pharmaceutical industry. Why? Because he didn't have data. He didn't have data to support what he had said. He also didn't recommend vaccines for pregnant women. We're the only country in the world that does not see pregnancy as a high-risk issue for COVID and serious COVID. So, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology immediately stepped up and said, no, this is recommended. So now it is confusing. I think it is confusing. Mm-hmm. And he tried to say that, you know, that these people who are going to be recommending these vaccines against his wishes are maybe have liability concerns, which they don't, by the way. I mean, it's between the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program and the so-called PrEP Act, doctors and hospitals are protected to make their recommendations that are consistent with the data.
Let me read in this comment from Claudia, because of course there's always some pushback. And this, this is Claudia's comment. Mm-hmm. There is much credible research showing the dangers and failures of vaccines. Just for one, a Cleveland Clinic study showing more likelihood of getting COVID and other diseases with more boosters, heart damage, miscarriages, etc., have been credibly connected to them worldwide. Claudia said she's disappointed we didn't choose any experts who would make those points. Paul, I want to give you a chance to respond to that, because you know there's people listening who've read this type of stuff.
And that's what you're up against. I mean, there are roughly 8,000 papers that are published a day in the scientific and medical literature in the world, and they follow a bell-shaped curve. Some are great, some are awful, most are more or less mediocre. You can find a paper that says anything. You can find, as Claudia's found, papers that say that vaccines, you know, the COVID vaccines say cause heart attacks or permanent heart damage or depression or suicide or whatever. But it's just doesn't comport with the vast amount of data that argues against that. But you're always up against this. I feel that Claudia is put in a difficult position, because this is the problem with the internet. You can very quickly find your group who has these same sort of false beliefs.
And what do you say to folks who question that profit motive, right? Like, I think that's where a lot of people's skepticism comes from. The idea that a doctor or a company or even the government is motivated to recommend a vaccine because there's something in it for them. And you've even said, right, the companies do need a profit motive in order to produce these vaccines, even if the profit margins are slim. So what do you say when people bring that point to you, Paul?
I think you should be suspicious of any profit-making enterprise. I do. Mm-hmm. And vaccine makers are that enterprise. But I think that there's no getting away with things. I mean, so for example, if a company misrepresented data or omitted data that they were submitting to the Food and Drug Administration and then ultimately to the CDC, there are systems in place like the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System or the Vaccine Safety Data Link that can very quickly pick up a problem. I mean, look at, for example, that Johnson & Johnson vaccine that was licensed in February of 2021. Very quickly, it was found to be a rare cause of clotting, including severe clotting, including fatal clotting of the brain, that drove that vaccine off the market. So there is no hiding. The pharmaceutical companies can try and misrepresent data, but ultimately the safety issues will be picked up.
Yeah, I want to read a couple comments. Susan on YouTube says, science is not a religion to believe in. It's a method of arriving at the truth. We have a major failure of science education in the U.S. Clarence says, I rely on my primary doctor, my primary care doctor, to advise me on what will work. FDA has no credibility with me. And Lauren, I want to bring you back into the conversation, because one of the reasons why RFK Jr. was elected was because there was this trust that sort of built up, you know, during the pandemic. And can you speak to that and what you found in your reporting as far as people losing trust in the government and why COVID was sort of the impetus for that?
Well, anti-vaccine activists really seized upon COVID to foment some of this dissatisfaction. They pointed to the COVID vaccine and said, look, you know, you don't trust this, so you shouldn't trust the rest of the vaccine schedule. And so you found a lot of folks that, you know, had questions about the COVID vaccine. It was a pandemic, you know, had reasonable questions and felt like public health officials had not communicated accurately to them. And they took that experience and then they put it on the rest of the childhood vaccines. And we've seen a slow but steady uptick in vaccine exemptions among kindergartners. And you've seen just a growing distrust of not only the COVID vaccine, but of all vaccines amid kind of this swirl of misinformation. And, you know, I think it's worth noting that many of the public health officials that I've spoken to say that even Kennedy doesn't yank vaccines off the market, his continuous questioning of their safety and efficacy in public is starkly different than what we've seen from previous HHS secretaries and could further damage the public's trust in these vaccines.
Yeah, we've seen that sort of play out in the real world with a shooting. And I think that distrust, that angst, that anger is sort of being directed at people and folks are sort of leaving. And can you talk about the morale that you're seeing among people who work in this field of public health?
I think when RFK Jr., for example, points to the American Academy of Pediatrics, he says, well, they're just in the pocket of industry, or he fires everybody from the ACIP because they're in the pocket of industry. First of all, it's not true. So, mm-hmm. And what is he really saying? He's saying these people are paid to knowingly ignore safety issues or to knowingly misrepresent efficacy issues. I think were that true, that would be awful. And I could understand why you would hate those people. But that's not who they are. Nonetheless, because he says things like that, he puts a target on their back to the point that they get hate mail or occasionally death threats, or in the case of the CDC, get fired at. I mean, it is not a casual thing that he does when he claims that everybody is in the pocket of industry but him.
And of course, Margaret points out questioning whether RFK is motivated by all the money he makes promoting anti-vaccine, anti-science conspiracies. Of course, he was an attorney working in that field at one point. Lauren, before we go to break real quick, maybe we could get this conversation going for the other side of the break. One of the other major things that has happened is a change in who gets grants from the federal government. And there's been a big shift away from grants for mRNA vaccine research. Real quickly, in about a minute, can you tell us what's happened so far?
Yeah, Kennedy recently announced that he was yanking about $500 million worth of funding for mRNA vaccine research, which left many public health officials highly concerned, as they find it to be a potentially fantastic way to further vaccine access. And, you know, mRNA research potentially shows great promise in fighting cancer and some other diseases as well. So there's been a lot of concern and, you know, consternation in the public health community that what Kennedy said about mRNA research, which was that it wasn't effective and worth investing in, is not completely true. And, you know, there's also some question on whether or not the president himself agrees with Kennedy's remarks on mRNA vaccines, considering he oversaw one of the most successful, if not the most successful, vaccine campaigns in history that involved an mRNA vaccine.
So on the other side of this break, I want to talk about the trickle-down effect, the change in research priorities, how that's going to change how companies react, how that's going to change how academics do their work. So let's hold that thought. And let me repeat our question for today. Who do you trust for vaccine information? Where do you get your health advice? Your doctor, public health officials, your friends, the internet? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. We are talking about changes to vaccine policy and research at the federal level today on Studio 2. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today, we are talking about changes in the vaccine policy and research since Robert F. Kennedy Jr. took the helm at the Department of Health and Human Services. What does it mean for public health, for your health, and for how prepared we are for the next pandemic?
We're asking you the following questions today. Who do you trust for vaccine information? Where do you get your health advice? Your doctor, public health officials, friends, the internet. Call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment right there in the chat. And let me reintroduce our guest this hour. Paul Offit is director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And Lauren Weber is health and science accountability reporter for The Washington Post.
Now, before the break, Avi teed up a discussion about the $500 million in cuts to federal funding of mRNA research. And before we jump back into that, we wanted to allow you to hear from HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy, who recently explained his decision to cut funding for this mRNA vaccine research, which was overseen by the Center for Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, known as BARDA. Take a listen.
After reviewing the science and consulting top experts at NIH and FDA, HHS has determined that mRNA technology poses more risk than benefits for these respiratory viruses. That's why, after extensive review, BARDA has begun the process of terminating these 22 contracts, totaling just under $500 million. To replace the troubled mRNA programs, we're prioritizing the development of safer, broader vaccine strategies, like whole virus vaccines and novel platforms that don't collapse when viruses mutate.
So, Paul, I know you disagree with what he's saying there, and you can certainly respond, but I also just want to ask you more generally, when contracts like this get canceled, how does academia and industry respond? Do like if you're a pharmaceutical company, now do you put your money somewhere else? Like, what's the trickle-down effect of this $500 million going away?
I think what people don't realize is that in many ways, the hero of the COVID pandemic was the National Institutes of Health. Why? Because in 2002, 2003, when SARS-1 raised its head in China and then, you know, spread across the world, but not so much into the United States, so we never really had an mRNA vaccine for SARS-1. Nonetheless, there was a lot of work on that mRNA vaccine for SARS-1, so that when SARS-CoV-2 did enter this country and start killing people in February of 2020, we were ready. Similarly, I mean, look at what NIH did in terms of funding research. They funded the research of Drew Weissman and Katie Carrico, who started working on mRNA in 1997, for which they won the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 2023. So that's the sort of the area under that tip. We see the tip of the iceberg when we have a vaccine, but I don't think people realize this tremendous amount of work that they're before that. So when BARDA, for example, when they withdraw the money from BARDA, one of those research grants had to do with bird flu, with H5N1 bird flu for an mRNA vaccine. Gone. Now, bird flu may never be a pandemic, but we lose now all that time to have it. So if it becomes a pandemic, we're much more behind the eight ball.
Well, I think about the mRNA research and the distrust that was sort of built up around it. And can you talk about that a little bit, Paul? Because people started saying, you know, when they were getting the mRNA vaccines, they thought that they would not get COVID, and yet people still got COVID. And so that distrust built up.
I think when we had a vaccine in December of 2020, and then it started to roll out in the first half of 2021, I think that vaccine was overpromised, in the sense that the sense was that it would prevent all manner of infectious disease. Because when you looked at, I'm on the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee, when we looked at those data in December of 2020, both Pfizer and Moderna's vaccine were like 95% effective against all manner of infection, mild, moderate, or symptom or severe disease. Well, those were 3-month studies. If those people had just gotten their second dose,
right,
you knew that 4 to 6 months later, you weren't going to be well protected against mild to moderate disease. So we should have made it very clear, this is to protect against severe disease. And although it will lessen transmission, you'll shed virus for somewhat less long and at lesser quantities, it's not going to eliminate transmission. And I do think people were forced to get a vaccine in 2020. 21. They couldn't go to their favorite bar, restaurant, or sporting event or place of worship. They were fired from their job. And I think, and then they get a vaccine because they're mandated to get it, and then they have a moderate illness, which is not trivial. You're home for a few days with cough and congestion and fever, and you're thinking, they lied to me.
Yeah. On this question of who do you trust now, I want to bring in another caller. This is Lindsay from Center City on line 3. Hey, Lindsay, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is that I don't trust government information anymore, even the CDC, which as a retired health care provider, I used to trust implicitly. I subscribe to a Substack, Your Local Epidemiologist, YLE, and that has a lot of information about measles, vaccines, ticks, all sorts of communicable disease and vaccine reliable studies and information, and that's who I trust.
Thanks for that call, Lindsay. Jeff says, can your guests offer a good place to find trustworthy information about vaccines? It seems these days it's hard to find information you can trust. Paul, I'll give you the first crack at that one. What do you tell people to do?
Well, so there are a lot of reliable sources out there. Unfortunately, there's also a lot of unreliable sources, the good news and bad news about the Internet. So the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital Philadelphia is an excellent source. I think the Verity Project now out of SIDRAP, which is in Minnesota, is an excellent source. I think that your local epidemiologist, Caitlin Genalina's program, is also excellent. So there's a lot of really good information that's up-to-date, accurate, and the trick is finding it. The easy way to tell whether it's good or bad is that usually the good sites aren't selling anything.
Lauren, I wanted to ask you real quick, what is on the horizon right now in terms of HHS policy and action that people are really looking for that could be potentially very impactful? Are there a couple of items kind of floating out in the next few months that folks in your field are like, this could be a pivot point?
Well, Kennedy has promised to discuss more of the causes of autism in the next couple of months. He has also said that the Maha Commission report, which is the second part of their commission looking at the causes of rising childhood chronic disease, could come out in the next couple of weeks. That's expected in early drafts that we have gotten to address vaccines to some degree, although we don't know what degree they're going to say something about that. And while we don't know what Kennedy will say about autism, I mean, my colleague Caitlin Gilbert and I previously identified in the last 5 years at least 36 instances of appearances where he falsely claimed that vaccines are linked to autism. So, that's definitely something that people are on the watch for here going forward.
Yeah, I want to read a couple comments. Stan says he trusts his doctor and my friends who are physicians. Lucky Stan has friends who are doctors he could talk to. Daniel says he trusts research now, doctors back then. Now, definitely not the doctors because they research less on actual medications and vaccines following the money. I'm going to bring in another caller. We have Nick from Phoenixville on the line. Nick, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, my comment is I'm 91 years old, and I trust vaccine because I was living before they were widely available. We had a smallpox vaccine when I was a kid, and yet high school classmates had withered limbs from polio, and we saw people in the iron lungs. And I eventually was an obstetrician, and when I first started practice, pregnant women had to fear German measles because if they got German measles in the first trimester, there was a high risk of birth defects. So nothing's perfect, but I trust them.
Yeah, thank you. That's Nick from Phoenixville. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was the HHS discussion about clinical trials and having clinical trials for every iteration of a vaccine. Could you talk about the RFK's recommendations on that, Lauren? And then I want to get your reaction to what the impact of that would be, Paul. Lauren?
I think you're referencing that RFK Jr. has made a push for placebo.
Yes. Placebo, excuse me, with clinical trials. Yes, exactly.
I just want to make sure I understand because, I mean, to be clear, no vaccine gets approved without clinical trials. So he has made a big push for, and Paul can speak to this more clearly as well, but he's made a big push for placebo-based clinical trials. And, while there's been some lack of clarity about what exactly he means about that in his previous comments, He seemed to imply he wanted to retest vaccines for placebo-based clinical trials, which would essentially mean that you could take like 5,000 kids in Chicago and some of them would get childhood vaccinations and some of them wouldn't. In the months since he's become secretary, he somewhat dialed down some of that rhetoric on that. But it's a little unclear what exactly they are pushing for here, but I'll let Paul take it from there.
Yeah, and Paul, you know, explain why is placebo typically used in clinical trials for vaccines, and why isn't there a new clinical trial for every iteration of a vaccine?
Right, so any new vaccine for which there's not an existing vaccine will have a placebo-controlled trial. So that's what happened with the COVID vaccines. Those were placebo-controlled trials. When a vaccine is sort of an improvement on an existing vaccine, so for example, the pneumococcal vaccine, pneumococcus is a bacterium that causes pneumonia and bloodstream infections and meningitis. The initial vaccine had 7 of the serotypes of that pneumococcus. Pneumococcus has like more than 90 serotypes. There's 7 prominent serotypes. So then a company said, all right, well, I want to improve that vaccine. I'm going to make one that has 13 serotypes. So now you had this 7 valent vaccine that was on the market that was clearly saving lives, clearly decreasing the incidence of meningitis and bloodstream infections and pneumonia. But now you had presumably a better vaccine. You're not going to test that vaccine against placebo. You can't give nothing to a child knowing that pneumococcus is out there, knowing it could hurt them, and knowing there's just an existing vaccine that at least offers some level of protection. That's what he wants. He wants you to do a placebo control. He wants to do a placebo control trial with the current polio vaccine, the inactivated polio vaccine, because it's made a little differently because we've had advances in things like protein chemistry and protein purification. So as compared to the original inactivated vaccine, Jonas Salk's vaccine in 1955, that is a better vaccine. But you can't do a placebo-controlled trial for a polio vaccine. Polio is still out there. We had a case of polio in 2022 in a 27-year-old man in Rockland County. You can't do that. It's unethical, but that's fine with him.
Julia on Facebook says, can we please be clear that vaccine skeptic means RFK does not support the well-established science that keeps us safe as a society? This term seems needlessly deferential to someone whose views are terribly dangerous to our world. I wanted to bring up an incident that connects here to our region. Christine Lane is a doctor here in Philadelphia who edits a medical journal called The Annals of Internal Medicine. That journal published a study of 1.2 million Danish children that found vaccines with aluminum in them were safe and had no link to autism. Then in online comments, RFK Jr. demanded that the study be retracted. The journal refused. They did not retract the study. But I'm just curious, Paul, what you make of that episode. It gets at this larger idea that perhaps scientists and journal editors could back down in the face of pressure if he sort of applies it from the bully pulpit.
I sure hope that never happens. I mean, that was a beautiful study that came out of Denmark. It was more than 1.2 million children followed over 23 years from 1997 to 2020. It was a beautiful study because in Denmark, during that period of time, children got anywhere from 0 milligrams of aluminum adjuvant vaccines to 4.5 milligrams. So you could look on a milligram for milligram basis whether there was any safety issue. And they looked at 50 different possible disorders that were either allergic, autoimmune, or neurodevelopmental. It was a beautiful study. And that's not the kind of study RFK Jr. likes, because he wants to try and make the case that aluminum adjuvants in vaccines are dangerous. So when he sees that, he insists that it be withdrawn. He immediately said that the senior author, Anders Vid, was in the pocket of industry. He tried to say, well, there's problems with the study, which Anders Vid immediately responded to and refuted. What RFK Jr. doesn't want is he doesn't want expertise around. And that's why he fired 17 members from the ACIP, because he wanted to stock that committee with more like-minded people like him who are anti-vaccine science denialists and conspiracy theorists. That's the what we're living now. Here's a man who has been shouting from the sidelines for 20 years as an anti-vaccine activist, and now he's making policy.
Are the guardians of science, in your opinion, up to the challenge here? Do you think the folks, so we're talking, I talked about this woman, Christine Lane, right? Like, that's just a person living in Philadelphia trying to live every day of her life. Now in the crosshairs, she decides, right, we're not going to retract the study. Do you have faith that that's going to repeat itself across academia, across research?
I think good science does win out in the end. I mean, Galileo believed that the Earth revolved around the sun. He bought into Nicholas Copernicus's notion that the Earth revolved around the sun, that the Earth wasn't the center of the firmament as dictated by the sort of Roman Catholic Church at the time. So he was made to sort of withdraw that statement in front of a tribunal. But after he did, he just looked back at the tribunal as he was walking out and said, and yet, he said, it still moves. meaning the fact of the matter is the Earth still revolves around the sun. Vaccines don't cause autism. And no matter how many sycophants or congresspeople or media venues or others that are disreputable scientists or doctors, RFK Jr. gets to mimic that thing that he's about to say. The fact of the matter is vaccines don't cause autism. We have a lot of information on what does cause autism. And so he's wrong. And ultimately, science wins out in the end. I believe that.
Yeah. And as we wrap up, I mean, do you think the damage that you have seen been caused here, do you think it can be repaired?
Yes, but I think there'll be more damage to come, and I think it's going to take decades to do this.
Real quick before we go, Lauren, I just want to ask you a question from Heidi, who's worried about the potential ban of mRNA COVID vaccines, asking could that actually happen? Real quick, we only have about 35 seconds. Can you tell us if that's something that could happen, Lauren?
I think an outright ban is somewhat unlikely, but I mean, I do think there are other ways to limit access to the mRNA vaccines. You know, we've seen either through research cuts, through not recommending it, and through casting dispersions upon it. So, but a ban itself, I think is likely unlikely.
Well, that is the voice of Lauren Weber, health and science accountability reporter for The Washington Post. Lauren, so appreciate your time today on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And Paul Offit, director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and professor of pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at Penn. Paul, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you to everybody who called in today. Lots of emails and comments online. We appreciate you weighing in. And thanks to our producers, Debbie Bilder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and Al Banks and Tina Calliquet. Thanks to you for engineering today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk with you tomorrow.